Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. And it is now or never. And as I have been asked to include, as much as I can remember, the debt is fraud. I go into the rants on this all the time, and I just want to be clear here that the debt is fraudulent. We, the people, do not owe that debt. And as we go through the political exercise, some of the things that will actually come out is the fact that if we audit the Constitution, when I say we, our states, your state, my state, when our state legislators audit the Constitution, it will refute everything that the Supreme Court has done. To be clear, when it comes to interpreting what that Constitution means, these justices in black robes, they can, you know, bamboozle us into saying, well, they have that authority, but that's not delegated. As a matter of fact, when it comes down to contract law, if you actually had a hard contract with the government or with any entity out there, and the judge has to make a decision, he can't interpret intent. Now, if it goes to a jury, the jury has to basically judge the case on facts and evidence. And that's what the Constitution dictates, facts and evidence, not feelings, not interpretations. So when it really comes down to a controversy between the states and the federal government, and the court uses those types of connotations, the only thing the states need to do is the states need to create their own tribunal, turn to the ratification debates and say, well, how was this defined? There it is right there, clearly defined. And it becomes evident that the courts, the federal courts, has been giving allowance, in other words, putting their finger on the scale, ruling in favor of the party that is not a party to the Constitution. In other words, they rule in favor of themselves instead of actually providing the full justice based on the law. Because as Madison and anybody will tell you, when it comes down to how a contract is being defined and the terms are being set and what these clauses mean, then those things become legally binding. These are stipulations. These were the stipulations that helped convince the states to actually buy into this compact. This is why the states absolutely need to wake up. You know, they're starting to realize, as a matter of fact, I had a really good conversation with a state senator, and there was a state legislative meeting just a couple of weeks back in Texas. And there were a few of these men that were, you know, men and women, I don't know. I was talking to a man, so I don't want to make the presumption that they were all men, because we have state legislatures of both sexes. of the two that exist, both of them could have been there. So anyway, as we look at the Constitution, or at least this is how he was referring to it, these legislators that were in Texas, and some of them were the Texas legislators, were all admitting that they know that we don't have a lot of time. We do not have a lot of time. This next financial fiasco will be the trigger for the globalists to seize America. You've been hearing me tell you this. And so he basically, this is the first time I had a chance to talk to him, but I want him to understand that if the federal government comes along and says they have to put aside the Constitution because of this financial crisis, he really needs to understand this. And so this good senator, this good state senator, needs to get the word out to everybody he knows that when this crisis comes, the state legislatures must take a stand and tell the federal government they don't have the authority to put our contract aside. And oh, by the way, we have just, it's come to our knowledge that all of this debt that you have created, you had no authority to do. And as a matter of fact, instead of going into, you know, the hands of some financial global bailout system, we're actually stepping in and suspending the federal government at this point in time. And we're going to audit you, and we're going to tell you what you could do, and those things that you could, had no authority to do, we're wiping them out. And we want to make sure the world understands that they had the responsibility, and they wanted to create debt with this nation. They had to make sure that this government had the authority to do that, because it's very clear in the Supremacy Clause that they could not create a contract, an obligation for America if they did not have the delegated authority to do that or for the purposes thereof. And bottom line, for them to spend money on things they had no authority to spend, and these foreign nations, they knew what they were doing. This was a collusion between criminals in our office who were violating their oath and violating the supreme law. The supreme law rules. And there's no doubt in my mind, this may sever America from the world. It may force us to actually be prepared to fight some kind of war. But I am telling you, this is the glory of God. He gave us this Constitution. And I believe that the one thing that'll keep every nation from attacking America is if America actually states that why is it that you're living and being part of this evil regime? Because once we clean house, once again, America becomes the beacon on the hill. We're no longer the manipulators in the back doors and in the, you know, these dark, dingy rooms. We actually become that beacon on the hill. So just keep this in mind. Folks, you need to get this word out. I mean, time is of the essence. I say this, it's now or never. Don't rue the day that when the trigger gets pulled and all of a sudden we're sliding into the abyss that you didn't do anything. That goes down to that the pain of discipline versus the pain of regret. Because I'll tell you what, you will gnash your teeth. And you will rue the day that you did not endure the pain of discipline. It's about time we actually just pull up our you know, what's the expression? Pull up our bootstraps and tie up and retie and tighten our feet so that we can get back out there and dust ourselves off. Don't want to forget that part of that little analogy. We'll dust ourselves off and we will get out there, and this Constitution will rule the world. It's not actually going to rule the world. It will preserve liberty for the world. If you really look at this Constitution, it's not about creating this dominant nation of, you know, tyranny. It actually protects us from that. It allows all people to have a self-governing system. But people, these other nations will have to be willing to set aside their language, their laws, and those types of things. They don't have to set aside their culture. It'll take a little while to understand, to come into this new concept. But I'm telling you, China would not, the people in the Chinese army will not lift a finger if they had the opportunity of having the freedom. Now, you get these levels of corruption, but I am telling you, the people of China, Tiananmen Square would be revisited. But I digress. We want to get into the political exorcism today, but there's just a few things that I wanted to kind of cover. Now, I know I talked about having John Durash coming onto the show, so I really do hope to do that interview with him. And actually, I'd like to do a series of interviews. because there's no doubt in my mind the NLA could become a real strong leader in helping counties and county legislators creating these committees. We've already got a few county parties that are trying to pressure this and trying to push this forward in Wyoming. So it's just a matter of starting to harvest this. We already know that, you know, there's this team of, I'll say, bureaucrats going around getting counties to, you know, pay money to become constitutional counties. I want to work with the NLA, Bob Schultz, and all of the other leaders of the essence of the truth of this constitutional gospel, this constitutional doctrine, I should say. I believe that we can actually instill the hope, because it's all about shifting your focus to constitutional compliance. Once we start saying, you know what, if you're a public servant and you're not going to comply with the Constitution, then you're gone. You're out. We're removing you. And we actually have to make them give us that power. We have to create that. And I believe that there's somebody in government, there's somebody out there now that would be able to figure out how and easily to do that, to sell that, so that the people then finally have the power to hold their public servants accountable by using the Constitution as their weapon. So, Bob Schultz, John Durash, those are two. There's two other interviews that I want to have. One is just the general state legislatures, because it's campaign time. And some of these legislators that are, I'll just say, advocates for the Constitution, they're champions for the Constitution, I would love to have them on so that they can actually, you know, talk about what they're fighting for in their state. So maybe Tony Randolph, who knows? And so maybe some of the good legislators that I know, maybe Ken Pendergraft or Tim Salazar, or Senator Salazar, Representative Pendergraft, Representative Randolph. I don't mean to be disrespectful, but I'd love to have these men come in. As a matter of fact, I'd love to have Rob Chase. I've actually had Rob Chase on the show before. He actually became a legislator in the state of Washington. I'd love to have him on. And so, because I know he's pursuing his seat again, and it's just a matter of, you know, bringing forth those people to you, the public, to say, we need champions of the Constitution. And so any of these men that are champions of the Constitution, that signed the pledge that they will support the Constitution, that if, you know, if it comes up that, hey, that's not supporting the Constitution, then they will not do it. They will vote against it, and they'll do everything they can to call out those who are violating their oath. You know, I know that's difficult, especially when you're in this, you know, this environment that you're kind of friends. And some of these guys are, you know, nice guys, and they're just voting ignorantly, or they're voting because there's some reward for them for doing these evil deeds. We actually have to hold these guys accountable to stand up. In the state of Washington, there was not one elected official last year in the state of Washington that actually stood up and called out everybody who voted for that in violation of their oath of office. And everybody who hasn't said anything as of yet are in violation of their oath of office. We are required to support the Constitution. And that digital currency bill that they passed was a direct violation of the Constitution. So everybody has some blood on their hands. And how great would you feel being that one legislator to actually stand up and say that? To say we have an obligation legally and morally to support this Constitution, and that law is a direct violation, and this needs to be repealed, and I am going on a rampage on my campaign of re-election to basically calling you all out. There's no doubt in my mind that the district that voted for that man or that woman that did that, there's no doubt in my mind that person would have a slam dunk re-election. And some of those districts that actually thought that they had a good person, All you need to do is find a challenger in those districts to say, look, he's sold you out by not saying anything. He allowed that to happen. He's being Mr. Nice Guy. Folks, it's time to go into the temple and turn over tables and create whips and lashes and beat these people out of public service where they don't belong. Anyway, so the other person that I'm hoping to get Naomi Wolf. I'd love to have Kurt Lash on because in the article, in his thesis, he, and I'm going to get into that today because we're going to talk about the 14th Amendment. We're going to get back to that. In his article, he really spells it out, and actually it's part three, so we will get to that. But Naomi Wolf actually is out there starting to talk about the importance of the elections and integrity and those types of things. And as a Native American, I believe if they start understanding how powerful the Constitution is, and the fact is, so most people think that when you become a part of this Constitution, that you lose your religion, you lose your culture and everything else because the federal government has actually violated the Constitution, enforcing everything to become godless. We should be embracing and celebrating the diversity of religious worship and religious diversity, period. As long as those religions embrace the liberty for all to choose whom they follow. And I believe that most all of the Native American cultures are just like that. I believe that those who come from China, I don't believe that they have this subjugation other than those who become godless. The godless folks, the communists, there's no compatibility for them here to exist, to try to actually go around and say, thou shalt get rid of religion. You must become secular, because that is a religion, this godlessness. It's the same thing with Islam. So we've identified that there are religions that are incompatible with living in America. In other words, these people should not have citizenship. And if they become active and subversive, they need to be deported. It's one thing to protect people because of the good graces of liberty and the power of the Constitution. But it's another thing to allow the enemy to live within who is trying to undermine us and doing evil deeds. Those people need to be shipped out, just like the Tories were pushed out because they already proved that they had nothing to do with liberty. They wanted to maintain the monarchical tyranny. And I hope you understand. That's why this past couple of shows, I emphasized how we broke away from that model of government, that theocracy of the British Empire. And so it is the final. I believe if you really look at Revelations and it calls, you know, the whore of the earth or what have you, there's some ties and relationships to the churches and these monarchs in Revelations. I mean, come on. Anyway, let's start getting, you know, kind of ready to go into Kurt Lash. So we the people have to stop being, now this is one of these little pet peeves that I've been wanting to say because it's election time. So let me focus on a shift, a paradigm shift that we the people need. This is you folks. This is me because I'm going to include myself here. We the people have to stop being so unforgiving of others when they get into office. In other words, let's say somebody has some shortcomings. You know, they had a drinking problem. Maybe they had an adulterous affair. But they've repented and they're on the path of, you know, trying to do good to others. I don't even care about whether they're religious or not. Again, I'm okay with somebody as long as they become the champions of liberty and of the Constitution and are willing to sign my pledge and actually hold this up. Because, folks, if they signed this pledge and they're representing you, that means that you have to watch them with your watchful eye, you know, like at the top of that pyramid. You have to be always watching them to make sure that they're abiding by their oath of office, that they don't entertain people, that they don't have any right of representation from them, that they vote the way in support of the Constitution, and that they call out others for not voting in support of the Constitution. I get the hate of sin. You know, I get it that we really hate the sin, and that it's okay to hate the sin, but we should love the sinner. And I personally have a problem with real evil politicians or people of, you know, I've told you in the past, for the longest time, I had a real bias, a real hatred towards the Russians. My experiences of late is how wrong I was, that I just judged a class of people because I was programmed as a child that they were our mortal enemies. I am finding that Russians in the Pacific Northwest, many of them are better patriots than the patriots that I know. They just don't understand. And that's maybe some of the differences of getting people educated. I'm hearing the same thing with Chinese immigrants, people that have lived here for the past 20, 30, 40 years and are starting to realize that it's not looking good in America. And if America goes, there's nowhere to go. That's exactly what Trevor Lawton from New Zealand has said. That's why he's here trying to fight the good fight. So I personally get this, you know, this non-forgiving people. And I myself have a real problem because there's no doubt in my mind, Obama, Clinton, these ilk, they knew the Constitution and they knew, and I know I'm judging here, but they had to have known what they were doing was egregious violations. And as far as I'm concerned, Nancy Pelosi and those ilk, those types of people, I just don't have any mercy for them. And I don't mean to be so harsh, but there's no doubt in my mind, they do not deserve to be at the helm of our government. And as a matter of fact, if the world that we owe money, at the beginning of the show, I told you that these people knew what they were doing and they were working with these people like Pelosi, Obama, Clinton, and so forth, Biden. As far as I'm concerned, when we take this back, if they want a pound of flesh, we can send them all of those who they colluded with and go, there you go. These people had no authority to do. There you go. You can hold them accountable. If you want your pound of flesh, it has to come out of these people who exercised powers that were not granted and are delegated, who directly violated the law. There you go. We have to stop focusing on the perfection of the person. And as a matter of fact, I asked people, and it was clearly pointed out by a very wise man to me a long time ago. He said, he pointed to the doors of a church, and he said, if the requirement to come through those doors were perfection, in other words, you had to be perfect in Christ, that nobody would able to come to church and be able to worship and be able to partake of the Spirit. And so that was profound in understanding that none of us are perfect. That was, you know, I was that old when I finally realized that we all fall short. And that was the need of the atonement. But we have to stop holding our public servants so harshly accountable for and not allowing them to actually do something, whether it's a religious, you know, transgression. It doesn't matter. You don't like the religion, the transgressions they made. My point is this, folks, that we have to stop holding people to such an unreasonable level or an unreasonable bar that they have to be this perfect. And as a matter of fact, when I come back, I'm going to emphasize the fact of how the left actually looks at those credentials as, yes, that's our guy because we control that person. That's exactly how they work, because they've corrupted them and they control them. We'll be right back after this. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, so you can't tell me that the appeal to forgive Clinton for him not inhaling, but yeah, I puffed on marijuana cigarettes. I mean, as a matter of fact, that was used to manipulate those Democrats that said, no, you know what, he's done drugs, I don't want to. And it softened them to actually vote for Clinton. In other words, you know, hey, all of us, you know, we've all sinned. We have to stop to think that we're actually the only time we're going to have that perfect being in ruling this world, ruling this nation, is when Christ comes. And until then, it's us. And there's many people that don't feel that they're up to the caliber. They don't feel that they, you know, they're good enough to actually serve in public service. You know, it doesn't matter where you've been or what you've done, as long as you've put yourself on the right path and understand the Constitution, then you are the most competent in the room. If you understand the Constitution and you're committed to abiding by it, you will not vote for any type of law. And as a matter of fact, you can call these things out. This is a violation of the Constitution. You should be the one person that everybody in the room, or at least hopefully we can get to a point where nobody rolls their eyes. But it's one thing if you're the only person in the state of Washington to call everybody out for how they've all transgressed against the Constitution with that digital currency. It doesn't matter if everybody's eyes roll. You're right. You've done what we asked you to do by living up and obligate or following and fulfilling that legal and moral obligation of that oath of office. It's that simple, folks. So as I look back, I cannot think about how America, not just America, Christians in America allowed Obama to get reelected in 2012 instead of casting a ballot for Romney. And so I look and go, you know, that I believe that that was one of the pivotal points. That America really had, you know, crossed this threshold to where, you know, they would rather actually have evil in office than an imperfect person. Because it was very clear. As a matter of fact, I really love the fact when Glenn Beck, he did this one special movie about the Christ, and the guy that he got to portray the devil, I think he was a Moroccan or something like that, but he looked just like Obama. And there was a lot of, you know, chatter about that. And to me, it really resonated because I just saw Obama as that level of evil. He should be impeached. He should lose all of his emoluments, i.e. the Secret Service, all of the money, as a matter of fact, all of his property, all of those things should be taken from him because he received them through donations and because of his access. It's not like he earned those things. Those things were given to him as gifts. All of these mansions and so forth, the money he's made, but there's a legal process to do all of that. First, it starts with impeachment. He should be impeached. Bill Clinton should be impeached. We already have the timeline. It is on our website that holds Bill Clinton accountable for selling out national secrets. The president does not have. His obligation of the oath of office is to support the Constitution. And when he actually sold out national secrets to a foreign enemy, then to China, and go look at the Winterm and Curry, timeline, this was in the congressional record in 1996. So, come on, folks. We actually have these guys by the goods. It's about holding them accountable by impeaching them and removing them from citizenship status and everything else. They'll never be able to vote again. They'll never be able to influence America again. We have to hold people to these standards. And, you know, let them live their life. I believe that when you really do such evil deeds where people have died because of you, lots of people have died because of them, and or has created such a threat to our liberty, that I believe that this should be one of those things that, you know, merits the capital offense. I mean, when we look at treason is a capital offense. It is the law. Now, I do know that Christianity, people have a hard time with that. But I do believe that, you know, there's really no way that person can ever give back. You know, the murderer, those people that have taken away the liberty of others by taking their life. And that's a tough one. And I know we all kind of sit on different levels and in different sides of the fence, but that's GR's position. Hate me for it, what have you. But bottom line, we've got to stop holding these unreasonable standards for our public servants. So now let me get back to this political exorcism. What I have is Professor Kurt Lash's doctoral thesis. This is a three-part article, and I'm going to focus on his third part of the article. Now, this article that he wrote, it's called The Origins of the Privileges or Immunities Clause, and this is part three, and this part is Andrew Johnson and the Constitutional Referendum of 1866. So what I want to do is I want to actually give you, based on his research, when you pull this in, you'll actually see all of the citations that he uses to support all of the facts he's going to present here. And so this is an academic article. Again, this was his thesis article. And if I remember correctly, this is why I want to actually, I'd love to interview this man, because I believe this particular thesis actually reached Scalia. And I believe that these men actually kind of conversed. And I think that it was a part of one of the rulings where we were taking back the privileges and immunities regarding the denial of gun rights. I don't know if it was the Chicago or the D.C. ruling or what have you. But anyway, I know that those people out there that are Second Amendment rights, they could talk about that to ad nauseum. But this is what Kurt Lash said. And this is out of his documentation. As again, for the ratification of the federal constitution, the key votes occurred on different days in separate state ratifying conventions. For the ratification of the 14th Amendment, the key vote took place on one single day, November 6th, 1866. On that day, congressional Republicans won a landslide victory in the national congressional elections. Both Republicans and Democrats made the election of 1866 a referendum on the 14th Amendment. Had the Republicans lost a congressional majority, this would have doomed any hope for passing the amendment and may well have triggered a new civil war. Instead, the Republicans received a national mandate to move forward in their efforts to secure the amendment's ratification and protect the rights of American citizens in the southern states. The conjunction of a proposed constitutional amendment And major national election created a political dynamic quite different than that which existed at the time of the founding. In 1787, the voters who needed to be persuaded were the members of the individual state ratifying conventions. Pamphlets and newspapers, editorials, were generally regional, and the conventions themselves often included days of detailed analysis and debate on the proposed Constitution. Now, let me stop and kind of explain what he's trying to tell you. The huge difference between 1866 and 1787 in the ratification, or actually 1788 in some of these elections, but those who were chosen to go debate were the ones who ratified the Constitution, because it was done by representation. Got to remember that the framers were such Republicans that they didn't leave anything to a popular vote. It was all done by representation. Shoot, when they decided to have lunch, they would actually choose. They were so Republican that I would think that when they had to, you know, when the Congress or body of men in a room that were politicians, like at the Constitutional Convention, when they decided that, you know, somebody needs to figure out what we're going to have for lunch, and they would just pick delegates and send them off and they would figure it out. That's how Republican they were. They didn't use a majority vote. And look at the benefits that they created by doing that. In 1866, now back to what Kurt Lash said. In 1866, by contrast, the relevant voters were the national electorate. And as a matter of fact, you got to remember that in 1787, only those people who could pay the poll tax were able to vote. In other words, it wasn't open to all of the citizens to choose those delegates going to that convention. It was only the landowners who could pay the poll tax. So differently, back in 1866, we started opening up our elections to basically riffraff. You know, people that didn't even own property. People that, you know, probably shouldn't have. Well, actually, I shouldn't say that. There were still some places and states that were still limiting those folks, but most of that was down in the South. As the northern states, and this only went to the northern states. Remember, he's talking about an election that was occurring only in the Union, not the Confederation. They didn't have congressional elections because they weren't in Congress in 1866. There was zero representation in Congress in 1866 or even after the war up to this point. Why? Because they left the Union. They were not going to be allowed into the Union, and by sending these Republicans back, these were called the Radical Republicans, by sending them back into that power, they actually held to their standard. When in 1866, when the 14th Amendment went out, it was told that the southern states could not join the Union unless they either ratified the 14th Amendment or they had to wait until it was ratified, period. And most people said, well, they joined by distress. No, they joined to alleviate themselves from having to pay the debt to Britain that they basically, you know, put themselves in such a lurch, in such an obligation. I'm telling you folks that this 14th Amendment and this election took Britain another set of elections, right? In 1888, there was another election and Britain still hadn't overcome the Radical Republicans. The Radical Republicans were still clinging on to the last vestiges of Congress, and it was in 1870 that they finally ousted enough of them and got enough of their corrupt beings into the office that when we go into the Organic Act of 1871, we'll find out who the authors and sponsors were. That's the stuff I want to do. I don't have the time. I've not done it yet, but that's what I want to do. I want to show you who their lead operatives were in Congress. So back to what Kurt Lash says. In 1866, by contrast, the relevant voters were the national electorate. Newspapers and pamphlets enjoyed far greater circulation and national penetration and were put to use by two dominant political parties, the Republicans and the Democrats. I mean, this was when we actually galvanized the two-party system, which happened in 1856. And it's in Why Counties Matter Most of how they did this. With the ability to coordinate and widely disseminate their positions on the proposed 14th Amendment, relatively little debate on the amendment took place in the state assemblies. A great deal of debate took place on the national campaign trail. This different dynamic has important implications for those seeking to determine the original meaning of the 14th Amendment. Originalist scholars of the 14th Amendment have long lamented the, quote, sounds of silence, close quote, in the state ratifying conventions, when combined with the coercive measures Congress used to secure ratification by the southern states, this silence seems to make determining the original meaning of the 14th Amendment doubly problematic. There is little we can glean from the ratification assemblies in the states, and those assemblies themselves seem to lack the same kind of popular legitimacy as those that met at the time of the founding. The result has been a far thinner originalist account of the meaning of the 14th Amendment than that which exists for the original Constitution. Once we understand that the key debates took place as a part of the national election and not in individual state ratifying conventions, however much the presumed methodology difficulty regarding the originalist study of the 14th Amendment disappears. There was a deep and robust public decision of the 14th Amendment, one that culminated in a landslide national election in favor of adding the text to the Constitution. As had been the case at the time of the founding, supporters and opponents of the proposed constitutional text developed sophisticated and specific arguments regarding the meaning of the text. The Democratic Party and men like President Andrew Johnson, Ohio Browning, and S.S. Nicholas played the roles once played by anti-federalists like Patrick Henry. Melanchthon Smith and Brutus of the anti-federalists, the Republican Party, and men like John Bingham, Jacob Howard, and George Paschal, and I would also say maybe it's Jacob Howard, who was Senator Howard of Michigan. Anyway, George W. Paschal stepped into roles which played by Federalists like James Wilson, Alexander Hamilton, and James Madison. Now, you know my opinion of Alexander Hamilton. He was a very persuasive man and very dubious. But in this particular case, I think things were a lot different by then. Republicans even had their own Publius, the pseudonyms Madison, who published essays in the New York Times that explained and defended the need for the proposed 14th Amendment. Because originalist accounts for the 14th Amendment had tended to focus on the framing debates in the 39th Congress, they have undervalued the underexplored and public political debates of 1866. Now, I myself have focused on the congressional debates, having access to the public debates, going to the newspapers really requires a lot more. But I do know that when you look at how the 14th Amendment was being stipulated in that congressional debate, that actually lent to proving that there was no there. In other words, they didn't subjugate any citizen by article or by the first section of the 14th Amendment in the first clause, the citizenship clause. The fact is that everybody has used voodoo, forked tongue soothsaying to reinterpret these things. Now, getting back to what Mr. Lash says. Most critically, they have completely missed President Johnson's important role as the leader of the anti-amendment party in the drama of the 14th Amendment. as the de facto national head of the Democratic Party. Now, again, remember, Johnson was originally a Republican under Lincoln. The fact was, he was a Democrat that was running as a Republican. Okay, so at the head of the Democratic Party, Johnson took the lead in crafting arguments against the amendment, though through what Bruce Ackerman has coined the paradox of resistance. Johnson sustained attempt to defeat the amendment both deepened and helped shape public understanding of the proposed text and its impact on the autonomy of the states. It was President Johnson, for example, who first declared that congressional efforts to protect the privileges and immunities of citizens of the United States required a constitutional amendment when Congress submitted and proposed the amendment that adopted the president's own locution. Anyway, Johnson responded by challenging the very legitimacy of the Republican Congress and making opposition to the amendment the focus of the Democratic Party in the fall elections. The subsequent national debate between Johnsonian Democrats and the congressional Republicans clarified the choice facing the country. Either accept President Johnson's assurance that the southern states could be trusted to protect the national rights of the American citizens, such as freedom of speech and assembly, or adopt the 14th Amendment and empower the national government to protect the privileges and immunities of citizens of the United States. Now, to be clear, when we look at what ended up happening, see, Johnson was not up for election. Okay? Johnson was not up for election in 1866. So what ended up happening, I believe Johnson was up for election in 1868, right? So because Lincoln was elected in 1860, and Johnson became the de facto vice president in 1864, and then Lincoln was killed, and so Johnson did his term. So I'm pretty sure, I'd have to go back and check, I don't think he was up for re-election in 1866, just because it's a four-year cycle. So who won the election in 1888 or 1868? And so the question is, I'd have to go back and look, isn't that when Ulysses S. Grant was actually elected? In other words, the Democrats took such a beating in these initial elections that for 1866 and then following, it wasn't until 1868. And the interesting thing is, because Grant was reelected. So in other words, the focus at that point in time for the British control of our government was on Congress. They didn't try to unseat. And as a matter of fact, I think they may have compromised Ulysses S. Grant because there was that silver scandal. But let me get back to this. Back to Rash's article or his thesis. Viewing ratification of the 14th Amendment through the lens of a national election also allows to see how politically salient events during the summer of 1866 transformed a dry theoretical discussion of the amendment's merits into an argument over what was literally a matter of life and death in the southern states. The July 30th, 1866 massacre of freedmen meeting in a convention in New Orleans became a national scandal. Now, folks, let me ask you this. Why is it that you've never heard about this scandal, that these men died? Let's find out how many men died, particularly when it became clear that state officials had led the attack. Republicans used the New Orleans not as a stark example of the need for the adoption of the amendment in order to protect the rights of speech and assembly against the abridgment. President Johnson's feckless response to the massacre only heightened public concern that the administration had no intention of securing the rights of national citizenship in the southern states. this political blunder. So in other words, it wasn't the fact that the Republicans took advantage of really politicizing this. In other words, don't we take a disdain when we see politicians try to use the slaughter of kids or these terrible events that occur for political advantage? Well, the Republicans shied away from that. But President Johnson refused to actually say, hey, this was really bad. This political blunder became a disaster when Johnson had his Secretary of the Interior, O.H. Browning, publish a letter representing the administration's position that the 14th Amendment was unnecessary in light of existing protections in state constitutions. Republicans around the country excoriated the letter and pointed to the blood-stained hands. In other words, they waited for this. Now they actually started, using that leverage to the blood-stained hands of the Louisiana officials as evidence that southern states could not be trusted to protect the national rights of speech and assembly. Only weeks after the publication of Browning's letter, Republicans enjoyed a landslide victory at the polls and a popular mandate to secure the ratification of the 14th Amendment. Despite the defeat of my policy, President Andrew Johnson, he actually quotes, quote unquote, my policy. President Andrew Johnson had one final act to play in the drama of the 14th Amendment. With ratification at an impasse due to the southern state policy of masterly inactivity, President Johnson met with conservative advisors and drafted an alternate amendment that he hoped would attract the support of northern and southern conservatives. Unlike the proposed 14th Amendment, which declared that no state shall henceforth violate the rights of the citizens of the United States, Johnson's alternate erased the proposed privileges and immunities and replaced it with a passive reformation of the comity clause instead of requiring states to enforce substantial rights like speech and assembly. And so let me just highlight that one part. Okay, I'm just highlighting the part to come back to. Anyway, Johnson's alternative would merely require that states provide equal access to a limited set of state-conferred rights. The proposal went nowhere, and Congress proceeded to pass a series of legislative acts that ultimately secured the ratification of the amendment. The 1866 national political struggle between Johnson and congressional Republicans opens a historical window on the original meaning and public understanding of Section 1 of the 14th Amendment. By making the proposed amendment the focus of the dispute between contending political parties, Johnson triggered a sustained national public debate regarding the importance of the Privileges and Immunities Clause of the United States. I'm going to pause right here. In Why Counties Matter Most, it didn't take long for the federal court to actually jump into the fray on this very particular issue of due process, because the Due Process Clause and the Privileges and Immunities. And they literally started redefining equal protection under the law. You'll actually find what and how they did that in Why Counties Matter Most. Folks, I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help, and we'll finish this in our next show. All right, on Friday.
Folks, I'm constantly providing you with case after case and giving you both the empirical information as well as irrefutable academic evidence that the federal government is operating well outside the bounds of the Constitution. In measuring outlays, the federal government is spending over 80% of your tax dollars on unconstitutional government. This is why we don't need a balanced budget amendment. We just need to enforce the Constitution. So what is it going to take for you to take a stand in getting the federal government back into the framework of the Constitution? To be clear, the solution is simple and does not require much work on any one individual, especially if everyone contributed to the effort. We only ask that you make a commitment today to contributing however you can and make the difference necessary for our posterity's sake. Send me an email at info@reclaimingtherepublic.org and let me know how you'd like to help so we can help you save our republic.